For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host Red Sale, and this week, author and publisher Moira Forsyth explores secrets, lies and sibling rivalry.
Things we have not told each other are the things that matter.
Historical novelist Bernard Cornwell discusses life at the sharp end of battle.
Oh, I love Sean Bean's interpretation of sharp. He was wonderful. I mean, Sean Bean was sharp.
And narrator Hugh Parmenter shares some of the tricks of his trade.
See him working things out and the processes he goes through to put his memories back together.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Moira Forsyth is the author of five novels, the latest of which, A Message from the Other Side, explores the relationships of two sets of siblings through two decades, starting in the mid-1990s. It's rich with rivalry, secrets and lies, and it's published by Sandstone Press, the award-winning Scottish publishing house she co-founded in 2002. She joined me down the line from Dingwall. Moira Forsyth, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
So, for those who haven't read A Message from the Other Side, can you set the scene a little bit?
Yes. This is my fifth novel. I've written a lot about siblings, adult siblings, and I've written a lot about families, parents and children. And I think I set out this time to try to write a love story, and I'm not entirely sure that I succeeded in that. But it's also a novel that's got a kind of mystery at the heart of it. It's a novel about two sisters who live many miles apart. And because they are so far apart, they're communicating by occasional visits, but mainly on the telephone. And that causes a problem in that neither really knows what's going on in the other one's life. And they edit their lives a little bit for each other. And it's that gulf of not knowing that causes the problem for them in the future and is at the heart of the mystery in the book.
Yes, I say in my introduction that it's full of secrets and lies, but actually it's not so much the lies, it's more lying by omission, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is. The things we have not told each other are the things that matter. That's really the kind of premise of it, if you like. But the scenes that are set in the what's called the factory, the kind of furniture warehouse that one of the characters, Gilbert, has and is running as a rather hopeless business, that came to me in a dream. I woke up from a really vivid dream about this place as a kind of second-hand furniture shop, but with an upstairs that was very sunny and light and was full of junk for sale and also rows of bookcases. And that was so clear. When I woke up, I thought, I can't waste this. This is too good. I was thinking, really, because of the shape and size of the place, of the old Spirella factory, which is in Letchworth in Hertfordshire, miles from where I am now, but I did used to live near there many years ago. And it was that place that seemed to me to be at the core of the story, because it was so atmospheric. So that was where the idea of the old factory came from, and I just simply transposed it to the Highlands.
There's a very strong sense of place and physical belonging within a landscape, whether that's London or in the Highlands. It's clearly something that matters very much to your writing.
Yes, it is. I write a lot about houses too, because I think houses are terribly important. And just as you say, that sense of belonging that Catherine, although she's English, once she has moved to the Highlands, feels that she can live here. She feels at home. Whereas for Helen, it wasn't a place she could live, and she has migrated back to London. Although London isn't always good to her, she feels more that she belongs there.
Yes, she and her sister actually swap places.
Yes.
In the course of the book, which it's that old thing of two very different cakes made from the same batter, isn't it? That they are very different characters, and yet there is this bond that links them through life.
I think that is so true of many siblings. My sister and I, for example, are very, very close, but we're completely unlike each other. And I see that in families all over, really. And I wanted to write not just about sisters, but about brothers. And Kenneth and Gilbert are the brothers in the story. And I was keen that I would show things from their point of view as far as I could as well, because I like to inhabit the characters, not tell the reader what to think, but allow the characters to give their opinions, not mine, and let the reader work it out for themselves.
Kenneth is very much a dour Scot, isn't he? He has a communication problem.
Yes, I think he does. I was really amused by the number of women who said to me after they'd read the book that they really didn't like Kenneth. And what did she see in him? And they were quite cross about him, as if he was a real person. And I had to say, well, that's just his character. That's it. I didn't feel as cross about him as they clearly did, but they seemed to see him as an arrogant and difficult man who demanded too much and was not a bit politically correct, whereas I see him as an unhappy man who has never managed to get relationships right, has tried hard and failed.
You unfurl the story over a 20-year period, which reminded me just of how much has changed since the mid-1990s to 2014 when the book ends. Did it strike you how different a world we live in?
Yes. I mean, I'm old enough to remember all that and further back. When I wrote my previous novel, The Treacle Well, that takes place over more than 50 years. So I went right back as far as my childhood, my young childhood, for that one. And I like writing novels that last over a period of time, because what you're trying to show is how people change, of course, and grow and things change for them, but they remain essentially those same people, and the reader should be able to recognise, oh, that's exactly what Catherine would have done at 20 or 30 or whatever. But yes, I am very aware that when you're writing about the past, you have to change things and make it clear that life was different then, in very simple ways, but it was just different.
Now, you also helped found Sandstone Press, which is an independent and very successful Scottish publishing house. That was back in 2002, when there were some questions over the future of publishing. What niche in the market did you see at that point that made you feel that setting up a new publisher would be successful?
We started with adult literacy. I worked then in education, and I was approached by someone who worked in adult literacy, and she told me that in Ireland there was a publisher producing novels, short novels, novellas really, for adults who come late to reading. And she said, what about you doing something like that? Because she knew we were beginning to publish and were thinking about what we might do. And I discussed that with Bob, and he was extremely keen to do that. So we started off with a series of novellas called The Vistas. And because we were writers, both of us, we knew a lot of Scottish writers, and we commissioned The Vistas from them. And I edited them, and it taught me a huge amount about editing and working with authors. But we also felt it was something really worth doing, because they were simple stories, clearly told, with a linear plot, and easy-to-understand characters, but not childish and not talking down to the reader at all. They were very successful. But Penguin Random House came in with the quick reads, which they were able to produce much, much more cheaply than we could. So we had to bring the business to a close, which we're very sad about, and we would really have liked to continue. But we went into non-fiction then, and from there, Sandstone just grew. And we found our niche, if you like, with publishing outdoor books, books about hills, books about climbing, running, the environment, things that really suited where we are in the Highlands. And in 2010, we went into fiction. But our fiction was never particularly Scottish. And we have authors from all over the world. And we're very keen to keep that sense of being an international publisher, particularly for the fiction.
This might sound strange coming from a blind reader and author, but the way you produce your books, they are things of beauty. You clearly take the presentation of what you write very seriously. It is something to keep and treasure.
I'm glad that you say that, because we do think very hard about it. And producing the Vista series, it taught us a lot about how a book should look and feel. And what makes it easy to read. So we're very conscious of font size, the leadings, the spaces between the lines, and how the book looks on the page. And with the Vistas, we published on a kind of cream paper rather than white, so that if readers were dyslexic, it was easier for them to read. So that consciousness, I think, has fed through into all the publishing we do now. And we also work with a wide range of freelance cover designers because we know how important a good cover is for a book.
In A Message from the Other Side, the upstairs of the factory that you mentioned is full of second-hand books, very, very many of which are hardbacks. And it made me rather sad for, well, not quite the passing of the hardback, but there aren't as many books published in hardback as there used to be. Do you regret that yourself?
Yes, I do. My first two novels were published by Hodder in 1999, 2001, and they were both in hardback first before they came out in paperback. And we would like to publish novels in hardback as a discussion. Well, some of our nonfiction obviously is in hardback first, but with our fiction, that's a discussion we're having because you're not going to sell very many in hardback now. Most people will wait for the paperback. So we're thinking about how we do that and whether we do it and for which books we will do it in future. So it's a discussion we're having, but up to now, we haven't seen it as being something that was commercially viable for us.
This novel is also published as an audiobook,
yes.
Rather finely read. Is that something that you feel very passionate about as well?
Yes, it's so important. I'm glad it's finely read because I haven't dared listen to it myself. But yes, it is important because it makes the books accessible for a wider range of people. And I love listening to stories myself. I absolutely love it. The radio is my constant companion when I'm not working. I'm not terribly interested in television, although I watch some things, but I couldn't manage without my radio.
And there are plenty more titles in the pipeline at Sandstone as well. Anything we should be looking out for later in the year?
In September, I'll tell you about a book I've edited, because I'm very close to that. It's a book by an author called Anissa Bouzian. She's French. Her mother was French, her father was Moroccan, and she was born in the States. And the novel Dune Song is set partly in New York, just after 9/11, but mainly in the desert in Morocco. It's a stunning novel. It's about a personal journey, but it's also about identity and where you belong. And I've very much enjoyed working with Anissa on this, and we're hoping that it's going to do really well. It has a stunning opening line, "I came to the Sahara to be buried."
Which actually brings me beautifully to my last question. I was incredibly taken by the idea that you have in A Message from Another Side, that there is one defining line that defines every person you meet. It seems like such a simple idea, and it wasn't one that I'd come across before. Where did that idea come from, and what's the single defining line that defines you?
I have thought this for a long time. It's more that if you know that thing about the person, you will understand them better. And sometimes, you know, when we meet people and we either like or don't like them, but then you learn something else about them and you think, ah, that's it. And you realise that you have them somehow more clearly in your head. And so it was that sort of idea. I think if I have a defining line, it's she has always written stories.
I think that's a fantastic thing for an author to be able to be defined by. Maura Forsyth, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you, I've enjoyed it.
Thanks to Maura Forsyth. A Message from the Other Side is out now in paperback, ebook, and audio formats. And Moira will be back at the end of the show for the books of her life.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB newsagent service, which delivers the latest news, magazines, and stories in a range of accessible formats to people with sight loss, is now free for under 16s. Reading can make the world of difference, and it's vital that all blind and partially sighted children can access the same content as their sighted peers in a fun and creative way. Current titles in the RNIB newsagent service include BBC Horrible Histories, First News, Aquila, National Geographic, and RNIB Blast Off. Formats include audio CD or USB, email or Braille. To register for RNIB newsagent, please call our helpline on 0303 123 9999 or email us at helpline@rnib.org.uk.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. Still to come in this week's show, I'll be talking to a relatively new kid on the narrator's block who's already got some great titles under his belt. But first, Bernard Cornwell is a prolific and hugely successful author of historical fiction. He's best known as the creator of Sharp, a brilliant but wayward soldier in the Napoleonic Wars. And though he and Robert Kirkwood began by discussing his Grail Quest novel, 1356, it wasn't long before Sharp marched his way into the conversation.
"1356" by Bernard Cornwell, read by Jack Hawkins. Now it was dark and he had no lantern, but the city's flames gave a lurid glow that reached deep into the church and gave just enough light to show the stone slabs in the deep crypt where the man struck at the floor with an iron crow. He was attacking a stone incised with a crest that showed a goblet wreathed by a buckled belt on which was written Calix Meis Inebrians. Sun rays carved into the granite gave the impression of light radiating from the cup. The carving and inscription were worn smooth by time, and the man had taken little notice of them, though he did notice the cries from the alleyways around the small church. It was a night of fire and suffering, so much screaming that it smothered the noise as he struck the stone flags at the edge of the slab to chip a small space into which he could thrust the long crow. He rammed the iron bar down, then froze as he heard laughter and footsteps in the church above. He shrank behind an archway just before two men came down into the crypt. They carried a flaming torch that lit the long, arched space and showed that there was no easy plunder in sight. The crypt's altar was plain stone with nothing but a wooden cross for decoration, not even a candlestick, and one of the men said something in a strange language. The other laughed, then both climbed back to the nave where the flames from the streets lit the painted walls and the desecrated altars.
One of the many Bernard Cornwell novels in the Talking Books library, which include The Warlord Chronicles, The Saxon Stories, his many Sharp novels, and the Grail Quest novels, is 1356. Bernard Cornwell joined me down the line from his home in Charleston in South Carolina. And first of all, I asked him why he based a book on a relatively obscure battle.
I read a book, I don't know, a couple of years ago about Agincourt, and everybody seems to have heard of Agincourt. Most people seem to know about Crecy. But very few people know about a battle fought in between those two, the Battle of Poitiers. And 1356 tells a story which leads up to and finishes with the Battle of Poitiers. And it was really a most extraordinary battle. I mean, in many ways, it's more interesting than Crecy, and even more miraculous in a way than Agincourt.
It's quite a brutal form of warfare that they used.
It's absolutely horrible. There were some excavations done at Towton recently, and they found some of the body pits of the men who had died at Towton. And I mean, you know, this is the same sort of battle. It's hand-to-hand fighting. It's what we call knights, but men at arms, and they're fighting with axes and falcon beaks and maces, and they're, you know, battering at each other, and they're in full armor. And when they dug up these bodies at Towton, they found that some of these men had been so terrified, they'd clenched their teeth so hard that they'd shattered their own teeth. I mean, it gives you an idea of the horror of those battles, that, you know, when you're driven to that extreme. And Poitiers is another of these battles where men are fighting at arm's length and they're fighting with lead-weighted weapons. And it must have been horrific and brutal.
Also, the form of warfare before the introduction of siege warfare, they basically destroyed the lands surrounding the castles.
Well, I'm listening to your accent, and this is a tactic which was used by the Scots against the English, and the English thought, hey, this is quite a good idea. This, it's called a chevauchée, which is a French word. I don't know if the Scots invented it, but they certainly used it. The idea was that you wanted to bring your enemy to battle, and if the enemy had any sense, then they probably tried to avoid battle because they knew they were going to get beaten up. So you made it impossible for them to avoid it, and what you did was that you spread your army out and you marched through the countryside and you destroyed everything. You burned things, you poisoned the wells, you cut down orchards, you kill the livestock. You just go on a horrific sort of journey of destruction. And what they're really trying to do is to destroy the tax base. And it's a very, very successful tactic. And the Black Prince, the son of Edward III, leads two great chevauchées through France in 1355 and 1356. And these are extraordinary long marches, and they cut right across France the first time. The second time, they go right up into the center of France. And they do an immense amount of damage. And the damage they do means that people can't pay their taxes to their lords, and the lords can't pay it to the monarch. And they're impoverishing with the French state. So the French really have to come out. The first time he did it, they didn't bother to, they didn't try and fight him. The second time, the French king thinks he's got to stop this. And so he marches to oppose him, and that brings on the Battle of Poitiers.
Now, you mentioned the Black Prince, who is a figure we don't really know much about. So how much of him was research, and how much was the writer's mind?
Well, you're right. We don't know much about him. We know very little about him. The little that we do know, he seems to be quite a nice chap. He was fond of luxury, fond of gambling. He appears to have married for love. He married a woman called Joan, the Fair Maid of Kent, who I suspect we can, you know, assume was a very, very pretty girl. She was actually a widow. We know that he was generous because we have some of his accounts, but we really do know very little about him. He first fought at the age of 16 at the Battle of Crecy, where he evidently did well. 10 years later, he leads this army at the Battle of Poitiers, and he wins. But he doesn't actually fight another battle for many years until he fights in Spain, and he dies soon after, so he never actually comes to the throne. The French remember him. They call him the Black Prince too, Le Prince Noir. And the nickname came much later, long after he was dead. But even in Napoleonic times, French mothers would say to their children, if you don't go to bed, the Black Prince will come and haunt you. So he's certainly remembered in France.
Now, it also features Thomas of Houghton from the Grail Quest series, but this is more of a standalone book apart from that series.
Well, it is, to be honest. I mean, the Thomas of Houghton, that Grail Quest series, was a trilogy, and so this is the fourth book in the trilogy, which doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. But the trilogy ended, I can't remember where, I think sort of like 4 years before Poitiers, and I thought, well, I've got him, he's around, so why don't I use him again? And I like him as a character, so I just brought him back for this book.
Now, many people know you for the Sharp stories. How different is the research in researching something which is tangible? You know, there are very good historical documents about Sharp's time, but in this time, in medieval time, you're looking really at scraps of information.
Well, we have, yes, you're right. It's you know, we have a wealth of riches for the Napoleonic period. I mean, lots and lots of people were writing letters and keeping diaries and wrote down their memoirs, I mean, from the ranks right up to the generals. For the Battle of Poitiers, we really have four chroniclers, of whom one or maybe two perhaps were there, though that's doubtful. But they certainly talked to people who were there. We've got a few other documents, and of course even the four chronicles we have don't agree about what happened there. And there is a lot of mystery about the battle, not too much mystery about what actually happened in it. Most of the chroniclers seem to agree, but it depends whose side you are on, how big the armies were. I mean, if you're a French chronicler, you tend to make the English army much, much bigger and the French army much smaller, and if you're an English chronicler, you do the opposite. But one of the great mysteries is where exactly it was fought. And to this day, we really don't know exactly where on that field or that stretch of country exactly where the battle was fought. You know, that we'd have no such mystery if it had been fought in the early 19th century.
Now, I asked on Twitter and Facebook for questions, and a lot of the questions were, will there be more Sharp stories? And the other story was, what did you think of Sean Bean's interpretation of your character?
Oh, I love Sean Bean's interpretation of Sharp. He was wonderful. I mean, Sean Bean was Sharp, and he had a huge influence. I think I'd written 10 of the Sharp books by the time they made the TV series, but all the books I wrote after that, I would see Sean in my head. So, I mean, I think Sean was quintessential Sharp. He was terrific. Will there be another one? Yes, I think there will. I wish I could say when that will be written, but I don't know. I've sort of promised myself that I will write another one because I want to, and I've kept a story back. I always said it was for my old age, but I've reached that already, so I'm not quite sure when I'm going to do it.
There are, of course, many of your books in the Talking Books library.
Well, I should hope they are. I mean, it would be pretty dreadful if they were not. So, I mean, I'm delighted that they are on the Talking Book series, and I think that's wonderful.
So how important is audio to you?
Oh, they're hugely important. But I listen to them in the car. I tend not to listen to them anywhere else, but I do like to have an audiobook on in the car. And I'm sure, like lots and lots of people listening to this, that you get somewhere and you instead of getting out of the car and going to do what you're supposed to be doing, you sit there to listen to the end of a chapter. Mm-hmm.
I am no heretic, the old man said. Your father was a dark lord. The count shuddered. Sins of the father are not mine. And the dark lords possessed La Malice. They say many things about the dark lords, the count said. They protected the treasures of the Cathar heretics, the priest said. And when, by the grace of God, these heretics were burned from the land, the dark lords took their treasures and hid them. I have heard that. The count's voice was scarce above a whisper. The priest reached out and stroked the hawk's back. La Malice, he said, has been lost these many years, but the Black Friars say she can be found, and she must be found. She is a treasure of the church, a thing of power, a weapon to bring Christ's kingdom to earth, and you conceal it. I do not, the old man protested. The priest sat on the bed and leaned close to the count. Where is La Malice? He asked. I don't know. You are very close to God's judgment, old man, the priest said, so do not lie to me. In the name of God, the count said, I do not know. And that was true. He had known where La Malice was hidden, and, fearing that the English would discover her, he had sent his friend, Fra Ferdinand, to retrieve the relic. And the count assumed the friar had done that, and if Fra Ferdinand had succeeded, then the count did not know where La Malice was. So he had not lied, but nor had he told the priest the whole truth, because some secrets should be carried to the grave.
Jack Hawkins narrating 1356, written by Bernard Cornwell, which is TB20464. It's also available in Braille and giant print. Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and to Bernard Cornwell. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Those who followed our series on The Colour of B. Larkham's Murder will recognise Hugh Parmenter as the book's narrator. But, as we'll hear, that's not his first foray into the RNIB library.
Tuesday, Bottle Green. Afternoon. B. Larkham's murder was ice blue crystals with glittery edges and jagged silver icicles. That's what I told the first officer we met at the police station before Dad could stop me. I wanted to confess and get it over and done with, but he can't have understood what I said, or he forgot to pass on the message to his colleague who's interviewing me now. This man's asked me questions for the last 5 minutes and 22 seconds that have nothing to do with what happened to my neighbour, B. Larkham, on Friday night. He says he's a detective, but I'm not 100% convinced. He's wearing a white shirt and grey trousers instead of a uniform, and we're sitting on stained crimson sofas surrounded by cream-coloured walls. A mirror's on the wall to my left and a camera's fixed in the right-hand corner of the ceiling. They don't interrogate criminals in here. Not adult ones, anyway. Toys sit on a shelf, along with an old Top Gear annual and a battered copy of the first Harry Potter book that looks like some kid tried to eat it. If this is supposed to put me at ease, it's not working. The one-armed clown is definitely giving me the evil eye.
Hugh Parmenter, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much.
I've been accompanied by your voice for much of the last week. I've just finished reading The Colours of B. Larkham's Murder. What a great book. Did you enjoy reading it?
Yeah, absolutely. I found it just fascinating. A very different subject matter, something that I didn't know a huge amount about. I didn't know that synesthesia existed. And so it's always great when you can learn something from a book as well as enjoy the trials and tribulations within it and the adventure and the story within it as well as learning something.
I think you catch both the determination and the vulnerability of Jasper perfectly. Was it a difficult part to prepare for?
Yeah, I suppose there's... You want to do it justice. Jasper, as a 13-year-old boy who is on the autistic spectrum and is obviously quite a different little lad. You want to do it justice, and I think obviously he celebrates his difference, and I think a few points in the book he touches on his love of being a bit different. But I wanted to do it justice and pay those differences in him the amount of respect that they deserved. I think certainly when it came to voicing a character who's on an autistic spectrum, there are a few things that I wanted to know as much about it as possible, and certainly sort of there's this good amount of research that needed to be done, and I had a lot of fun doing it actually and learned a lot. But I think the sensitivity of him was the key thing. And I think, saying that's lovely to hear that you think the vulnerability comes across, because I think that's obviously a crucial part of him. But it is that the determination and his love of his differences that makes him quite a special character.
He has a wonderful self-knowledge whilst also finding it quite difficult to know other people. It's quite a dislocation between this rather knowing 13-year-old boy and this very naive 13-year-old boy.
Yeah, it's quite a dichotomy, isn't it, between the two. I think he understands the world around him in a very different way to everyone else, and you can see him, you can see him working things out and the processes he goes through to put his memories back together are quite extraordinary, obviously using the painting primarily to do that. And you do sort of the whole time you're just hoping that he's gonna be able to get through and not put himself in too much danger by dealing with things the way that he does in his very kind of independent way.
It must have been quite difficult for you reading The Colours of B. Larkham's Murder to have Jasper describing voices in ochre yellow and grubby brown and so on and so forth. You presumably don't yourself think of voices in those kind of terms. Did you find yourself bending towards his point of view as you were reading?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was probably one of the biggest challenges, and certainly something that I felt a little bit of pressure over, because I think, the way that it's written, as you read off the page, you're going to interpret it in a different way. Everyone's yellow ochre is probably slightly different to everyone else's. So I felt a certain amount of pressure being, well, this is the way that Jasper hears it. This is the tone of voice that is specific to that. But I definitely felt that going through the book, I did start to hear things in colours. When I was at drama school, we worked a little bit with colour psychology, and it's definitely something that I found useful. I think a lot of the sensory work that an actor does, you know, attributing feelings to colours and things like that, there were overlaps there. So there were things that were recognisable, and actually eventually really helpful in getting across a feeling or a sensory reception to something.
When you first pick up a book that you're going to be narrating and give it a first read through, are you just like the rest of us, turning the pages, waiting to find out what comes next? Or are you reading it with that professional eye that starts taking it to bits? How could I perform this? How would I do it justice?
Generally speaking, I think, yeah, if I know that it's something that I'm going to be working on as a narrator, then I will start working on it straight away. I think it's important to try and capture that initial instinct that you have with a character, whether that's a voice or a tone or a sensitivity, whatever it is. I think it's important to capture that initial feeling about it. So I'll be going through it and making notes as I go. But as much as possible, you know, as a reader, trying to enjoy it. I think it's always nice then when you're reading something that isn't for work and you can kind of switch off a little bit. But at the same time, in the same way as, you know, working as an actor, you're going to be watching a film with a certain amount of distance and thinking, oh, I wonder how they did that shot, or, you know, I wonder how that piece of music was thought up and in what way that, you know, generates feeling. I think there's always a certain amount as an actor or a performer, there's a certain amount of understanding and respecting the craft all the time.
And do you mark the book up as a script with lots of different coloured pens to remind you which voice you should be slipping into?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I when I first started doing audiobooks, I think a few years ago, I would get sent the script in the post in this huge, you know, huge package, and I'd have all my coloured pencils out. And that was before I had an iPad, which then made things an awful lot easier, because it not only, obviously, I can mark up the script there with all the different colours, different highlighters on the iPad, but also it makes turning the pages a lot easier and a lot quieter to record. So you're not stopping every 2 to 3 pages to bring the next few pages up and shuffling all the pages about.
You've done quite a range of books, from books about dogs for children and much younger adults, some fairly gritty thrillers, and a book about the joys of surfing in Cornwall, I think, called Kook.
Yeah.
Do you have a particular favourite?
In terms of genre or an audience, I don't think so. I mean, I think the books for young adults or for younger children tend to be very colourful and have lots of interesting characters. I remember doing a series of books called I'm Not a Loser by Barry Loser. I mean, it was written by a guy called Jim Smith, and they're great fun. And there were quite a few versions. And I remember doing the first couple and thinking, okay, well, there are all these various teachers and characters in it that, you know, you're creating all these wacky voices for. And certainly for children's books, you can be pretty bold with the voices that you can do. It was just then became a slight problem towards the 6th and the 7th version of the book, when you think, crikey, I don't know how many more accents I've got left in me. You know, I'm doing a Botswana and PE teacher now, or, you know, you're trying to make a slightly less Glasgow version Scottish or for another teacher, and it keeps you on your toes. I think the kids' books are really good fun. At the same time, obviously, doing the more adult books can be really challenging and be very rewarding in a different way, in trying to match the level of tension or the quality of the writing. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of fun to be had in doing that justice as well.
Now, one of the things that narrators of audiobooks tell me is that they love doing the books because they can be the entire ensemble cast. I noticed from a few of the books that we've got in the RNIB library with your name as the narrator, that actually they've been with two, or in one case, three other narrators. It's something that's becoming a little bit more of the case with audiobooks now. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's that's the actor's dream, isn't it? Is play all the parts. I think that's it's always good fun to do that, and you can take a real sort of autonomy and over the piece as a whole, and you can map out the arc of the story. And obviously, being in being solely responsible for that is really good fun. I really like sharing books with other people, because before going in and recording, you'll be then listening to the other narrator's voice, or maybe a little excerpt of what the character that they're recording. You go, okay, well, I didn't see the character like that, and actually, that's really interesting that you've interpreted it in that way, and that can then feed into your performance. I just did a book recently called I Was Born for This, which was two of us, two main narrators, and it's about these two young people who don't know each other for most of the book, and then meet, and it was really, really useful actually hearing what the other narrator had done, I think it really improved the performance of the chapters that I read.
Do you think that as more audio versions of books are being made, more books are being simultaneously published in audio, that we will see more of them having more than just one narrator?
I think so. I think there's an argument for both, isn't there? I think as a listener, you can get comfortable and you can really enjoy one person's particular voice. But I think as well, you know, on the other hand, it's fun to listen to a few different characters, you know, almost a bit more like a radio play.
Mm.
And I think there's certainly scope for that. And I think, you know, the more colour and the more different tones of voice that you can get into a story, ultimately, the richer it is.
And how do you read your books? Audio or print?
Generally print. I do obviously listen to quite a lot of podcasts and listen to the radio a lot, but both I'm quite old school when it comes to reading. I like to let my own imagination in my head fill the words a little bit and create the sounds in my own head.
And finally, have you read a book recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners as a recommendation for their summer holiday?
Well, I recently reread Papillon, actually, which is the Henri Charrier, yeah, which obviously I'm sure a lot of your listeners will know, but I love the story and the adventure in that. I think it's, yeah, one of the best books I've ever read. Aside from that, I've just finished reading a Brené Brown book called Daring Greatly, which obviously is non-fiction, but it's Brené Brown's a fantastic thinker and all about harnessing the power of your vulnerability and seeing vulnerability not as a weakness, but actually as a strength which helps you understand what's important in your life. Yeah, I thoroughly recommend that. I think it's a really great read.
Well, there's a couple of great recommendations to put in the suitcase alongside The Colours of B. Larkham's Murder by Sarah J. Harris. Hugh Parmenter, thank you so much for bringing a wonderful book to life for me and many other listeners, and for being a guest on Read On.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
I want to go home. Please, Jasper. Concentrate. It's not for much longer. Dad's muddy ochre has a yellowish pleading tone. I can't do this. I'm too young. I can't do this. I'm too young. I speak loudly, but Dad doesn't hear. Jasper's hardly an ideal witness in your investigation, he says. There must be other boys at his school who can assist you. Boys who don't have as many special needs. I need to go home. That's my special need. My tummy's hurting. No one's listening. They never do. It's like I don't exist. Maybe I've melted away beneath my fingertips into nothing.
I understand your concerns, Mr. Wishart. I'll raise them at our case meeting this week, but we need to look closer at Jasper's relationship with Miss Larkham and Lucas Drury. We believe he may have information that could assist our inquiries. He may have made notes of important times and dates in their alleged relationship.
I doubt it.
A fluttering of pale lemon. One of my notebooks protests against Dad's probing fingers.
Look at this entry. The people going in and out of B's house have only basic details.
Black blazer enters, pale blue coat leaves, etc. Jasper has no sense of what they look like, even if they're teenagers or adults. I doubt he'd be able to identify Lucas or any other boy.
Dad flicks through my notepad.
Most of Jasper's entries don't even record people. They're his sightings of the parakeets nesting in Bee's tree and other birds. He's a keen ornithologist.
Rusty Chrome Orange's hand dips into a box and pulls out a steel blue notebook with a white rabbit on the front. That's not right, I say, surprised. The rabbit doesn't belong there.
Thanks to Hugh Parmenter. I'm sure we'll be hearing plenty more from him in years to come. The Colour of Bee Larkham's Murder, written by Sarah J. Harris, is TB 703009, and it's also available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library. For more information, go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly, and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
Now it's back to Moira Forsyth for the books of her life. Moira, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading or make you want to become a writer?
I can't remember not reading, and I can't remember not writing. I think as a child, I was enchanted by Alice in Wonderland and still am. But the novel that made me, I think, realise that you could create a whole world in a novel was Philippa Pierce's Tom's Midnight Garden. It's a magical, moving novel. And I find it just as enchanting now as I did when I read it as a child. I lived inside that novel, and just as I'd like readers to be able to live inside mine while they're reading it.
If, standing alone on the back doorstep, Tom allowed himself to weep tears, they were tears of anger. He looked his goodbye at the garden and raged that he had to leave it. Leave it and Peter. They had planned to spend their time here so joyously these holidays. Town gardens are small, as a rule, and the Longs garden was no exception to the rule. There was a vegetable plot and a grass plot and one flower bed and a rough patch by the back fence. In this last, the apple tree grew. It was large, but bore very little fruit, and accordingly the two boys had always been allowed to climb freely over it. These holidays they would have built a treehouse among its branches. Tom gazed, and then turned back into the house. As he passed the foot of the stairs, he called up, "Goodbye, Peter." There was a croaking answer. He went out onto the front doorstep, where his mother was waiting with his suitcase. He put his hand out for it, but Mrs. Long clung to the case for a moment, claiming his attention first. "You know, Tom," she said, "it's not nice for you to be rushed away like this to avoid the measles, but it's not nice for us either. Your father and I will miss you, and so will Peter. Peter's not having a nice time anyway with measles." "I didn't say you'd all be having a nice time without me," said Tom. "All I said was..." "Hush," whispered his mother, looking past him to the road and the car that waited there and the man at its driving wheel. She gave Tom the case and then bent over him, pushing his tie up to cover his collar button and letting her lips come to within a few inches of his ear. "Tom, dear Tom," she murmured, trying to prepare him for the weeks ahead. "Remember that you will be a visitor, and do try... oh, what can I say? Try to be good."
Tom's Midnight Garden by Philippa Pierce is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB2526, narrated by Elizabeth Proud. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
There are lots, and I do a lot of rereading of the Victorians and others, but I'm very fond of the work of both Elizabeth Bowen and Elizabeth Taylor. And I think for a rainy day, I'd probably want not my favourite Taylor, which is In a Summer Season, because that's very much for hot days, but A Game of Hide and Seek, which is a very subtle and moving novel. But if I just wanted something to cheer me up, I'd reread John Mortimer's Rumpel of the Bailey. I think it's hilarious, and I love that.
Do you get a lot of rainy days up in Dingwall?
Not nearly enough for reading books.
Mrs. Thripp rang me at home again that evening and told me that her solicitor, Perfect, had fixed up a hearing in 10 days' time. She wondered how she could live until then and told me I was her only friend in the world. I was comforting her as best I could and stemming the threatened flow of tears over the wire by saying, "You'll be free in a couple of weeks. Think of that, old darling." When I noticed that Hilda had come into the room and was viewing me with a look of disapproval, I put down the phone. I suppose to a hostile observer the movement may have looked guilty. However, she who must be obeyed affected to ignore it and said casually, "I'm having tea with Dodo tomorrow." Dodo? "Dodo Perkins and I were tremendously close at Wickham Abbey," said Hilda coldly. "Oh, Dodo, yes, of course, yes. The live one. She's living in Devon nowadays. She's running her own tea shop." "Well, nice part, Devon. You won't have seen her for some time." "We correspond. I sent her a postcard and said let's meet when you're next up in London." She gave me a look I can only describe as meaningful. "I want to ask her advice about something. We may do some shopping and have tea at Harrods." "Well, go easy on the chocolate ghetto." "What?" "I know how much these teas at Harrods cost. I don't want to see all my profit on the disorderly house vanishing down Dodo's little red lane." Hilda ignored this and merely gave me some quite gratuitous information. "Dodo never liked you. You know that, Rumpel?"
A wide selection of John Mortimer's Rumpole books is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library, including this Talking Books version of Rumpole of the Bailey, narrated by Nigel Graham, which is TB8609. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Well, I'd like to share them with them with something which is very much a summer book. It's a book for hot days. And it's a book I edited recently, and we've just published it at Sandstone. It's the journalist Rhiannon Lucy Coslett's debut novel, The Tyranny of Lost Things. There's an audio being made of that now, I believe. Although it's not ready yet, but there will be one. And I loved working on that. It's about London in a hot summer, and what it's like to be a very young woman there now. So it's about a bohemian past and a present where young women find it difficult to get places to live that they can afford to live in, and how they have to manage their way through relationships in a much more difficult environment than I think I encountered as a young woman. Outside in the front garden, the tree was bearing small, strange fruit, about the size of an apricot and orangey-yellow. We didn't know their provenance, but others did, and they came with carrier bags. Some would knock on the door and ask to harvest, others didn't. I recall particularly a little boy, plump and olive-skinned, standing shyly on the doorstep. At the end of the path was a stationary black cab. "Can we pick your fruit?" asked his father, the cabbie. "We were driving past. We haven't seen them since we moved here. They taste of home. He is so excited." Smiling, the child handed me some and showed me how to peel them. "Sheshek," he said. "Loquat." "You must eat them right away," his father said. "They perish in a matter of hours." They tasted sickly sweet, sticky. I imagined the boy and his dad returning to their kitchen, devouring them, telling stories about the old country. I liked them. Less so, the woman I found up the tree as I left the house one balmy evening in early June. She was right up in the highest branches, armed with plastic bags and watched fretfully by a younger relative, a son perhaps, from the pavement below. "That's our tree," I said, standing there in my cocktail dress. I just dipped dyed my blonde hair pink and had a cigarette in one hand. There was a bottle of wine tucked into my armpit. He looked embarrassed. From behind the leaves in a foreign tongue, the woman let out a stream of what I assumed from her tone was abuse. "I'm sorry," he said in heavily accented English. "She says that it is her tree." "I live here," I said. "It's my tree." "I don't mind, but I wish you'd asked. What, I could have been naked up there." I gestured at my bedroom window, which to her was eye level. The woman shouted some more, her words unfurling rapidly like a party streamer. "It's fine," I said. "Take them." "She used to live here," he said. "Her father planted this tree. She says it is her tree." "When?" 50 years ago. "It was possible," I concluded. "This house had histories that predate that of my parents."
Moira Forsyth reading a passage from The Tyranny of Lost Things by Rhiannon Lucy Coslett. The novel is out now in paperback and ebook, with an audiobook version due to be published in the autumn. Moira Forsyth, thank you very much for being a guest on Read On and sharing your obvious love of books and reading. Thanks again to Moira Forsyth. Don't forget, if you want to share the books of your life, you can do so by emailing the show via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter @talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.